Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again. Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Is this a man's own self-help book to himself?
But I think I found some things in his logic that was contradictory, which will be more fun to talk about.
Wow! You mean I don't have to throw my tray of tater tots at the waitress because I asked for curly fries? Welcome everyone to the Toot Around Podcast. My name is Richard.
My name is Austin.
Today, we're here to talk a little bit of philosophy, a little bit of bro-sophacy.
Broism.
This is the bros' favorite philosophy, Stoicism, and with their chief leader, not actual philosopher, but Marcus Aurelius, the most famous work for Stoicism, Meditations, his personal journal that he never intended to be read, but millions have read now as it is. So
also this is seen as a Stoic work, which we're going to break this down. This is a review analysis of Meditations, and this will just be a whole discussion on it. What if you have read the book, this can maybe bring back some fresh memories and perspectives about the book. If you haven't, this could be a good jump start to, as we talk about the book and you find it interesting and fascinating, then go off and read it after or during the video, however you feel. And please, how we're going to structure this is giving background information on Meditations, of context, the author, what is this, what is Stoicism, all of that juice. And then we'll get into the points made by Marcus Aurelius. Because as you said, the first thing to be very clear about in Meditations is this was not a book written as a narrative to be read by an audience. It is not structured as such. It is structured. There's 12 books in this, in Meditations. And the only reason there's these 12 books that are titled like that is because in the first place, he ran out of scroll room, meaning that he was writing on scrolls and writing on paper and just the paper would end and you'd get a new paper. That is why it's structured even that way. These were just jotting down Marcus Aurelius' thoughts.
Yep.
And as he says in this book, a lot of the times you'll read, it says you, he talks to you, you, you. He's talking to himself.
Yep.
And I don't know if you did know this because we read the same copy, which the one we're looking at is Meditations by Marcus Aurelius that is translated by Gregory Hayes. It's the one I think you and I, it's the only one we've read, but also it's highly recommended by.
I read another copy as well.
And you prefer this one?
I prefer this one. So I've read two different translations.
Yes.
I would recommend the Gregory Hayes translation. Awesome. So would most of the internet.
Great. And yeah, this one, so this is translated by Gregory Hayes. There's a foreword by Ryan Holiday. And I say this because in the translation, there's an introduction by Gregory Hayes where he gives the background info of the book. So everything I'm saying here was said by Gregory Hayes. And one of the things he was mentioning was that Meditations wasn't even the title of the book, or because this wasn't a book. It's just a made up name is Meditations. The earliest transcript copy that we have of Meditations, meaning this was a copy of copies of copies of copies that survived, the original Meditations does not exist. We don't know where it is. It was just translated over time. But the original title that was attributed to this introspection that Marcus Aurelius wrote down was called To Himself, not Meditations.
Yeah.
And the To Himself title is more accurate than Meditations as a title, Gregory Hayes says. And
yeah.
Do you find that to be true as well?
I mean, yeah, obviously. It's the whole book is Marcus Aurelius writing lessons to himself that, yes, clearly he knows these things, but it's important enough that he wants to be reminded, especially during harder times, of like, during moments of pressure. It's better to read back on when you were stronger, when you were more clear of mind. That's kind of the purpose of this stuff. Also, when you write things down, it helps you remember things, and it helps you articulate in your own head what you think.
Definitely. And this, to give that point of view as well, he was writing this in the 170s AD. He died in, I believe, 180 AD, so it was written toward the latter portion of his life. For those who don't know, Marcus Aurelius was the emperor of Rome, and he was seen as a benevolent emperor compared to some others. I mean, if you put out Nero or...
His successor,
which is his child.
As much as people like to say, hey, Marcus Aurelius, wise man, all these things, wise men don't always raise the best kids, I guess.
Commodus was his kid.
Yeah.
And Commodus was not seen as a kind ruler. Ooh. And a lot of that, as Gregory Hayes says, is the Senate controls a lot of the narrative as well of what is talked about after you pass. And Marcus Aurelius had a better relationship with the Senate. And obviously Commodus, I'm sure, did bad and awful things. And who knows? I don't know the history behind Commodus. I just know he's seen as a bad emperor alongside of Nero and Caligula and others. Mm-hmm. Or a tyrant is what they would label them as if they're really bad. And Commodus was labeled a tyrant.
Yep. So
what do you think about that? That he has all this introspection, this entire book is about, and we're going to say the word book, even though it's not wasn't meant to be written as a book. But this entire book is his introspection as a man. You see this person who is clearly trying to make their ethical decisions and live a fulfilling life, yet did not translate down to his kid. What does that say about the man? Do you think that is important to mention?
This could get into almost a completely separate conversation.
Yeah.
One, you are right with the Senate basically gets to determine the legacy of the emperor. So who knows? Maybe Commodus was a similar emperor to Marcus Aurelius, but Aurelius actually was a much more talented politician. And so that's why his legacy is remembered compared to Commodus. Who knows? History is fine. But generally, it's fine to just trust like historians saying Commodus was a bad leader. The greater thing is whether your kids are a reflection of you as a parent in its entirety. And I mean, throughout my life, I've been kind of on both sides going like, hey, is it mostly environmental? Is it biological? You look at, you know, parents of like serial killers, and generally speaking, a lot of the parents look completely normal, didn't abuse the kid, and just kids messed up, and sometimes there's nothing you can do.
One huge example,
how much is nurture versus nature?
The mother of the Columbine shooters?
Yeah, I've looked briefly, but I bet you've... Shooters. Yeah, she seemed fairly normal as far as I'm concerned. Any reporting didn't see too much, like, information didn't come out that she was abusing her kids or anything.
I know she dedicated a lot of her time afterwards of trying to understand and warn other parents about telltale signs of she didn't see it coming at all. And
also, what parent would even want to see it? Like, I imagine there's blinders for
your own
child. Why would you ever look with, you know, see the worst from your child?
Right.
But point being, it's possible it's not all on Marcus Aurelius of... If he was a terrible father, it could have been his kid just was rotten.
Other point to make is while Marcus Aurelius was writing this, he was out at not fighting in the fields, I'm pretty sure, but he was out on campaigns, on the campaign trail, not as in getting elected, he was emperor, but against on the northern frontier of the Roman Empire at the time. And they were called, I don't want to get this right for historians here, the... Marcomatic Wars were going on in his latter life here. A lot of this was written, we suppose, so we don't know exactly when and where, but historians suppose a lot of it was written while this war was happening, while he was on the campaign on this northern frontier. So that also gives context of what he was thinking about and death and all of this very existential stuff going on in his head.
He does focus a lot on death in this book.
Quite a bit.
I would imagine him being, you know, on campaign... confronted with death almost daily. Maybe daily, who knows? At least weekly.
He talks about chopped off heads. We're going, did he just see that? And
I would imagine it'd be, it's on its mind.
Yes. And to give some more context on the background information, this text, as we just started off, we said, hey, broicism, stoicism, look at this. What is that? To be clear, first, he was not the founder of stoicism. That was Zeno. It was the founder of stoicism. And the reason it's called stoicism in the first place is the word, the stoa part of this means porch in Latin, I think is the term. But it means porch, meant porch. And so the word stoicism actually means, to the literal definition of the establishment, the philosophy of the porch. Because if you're talking about an ism, like you talk about ism is the study of or the knowledge of, da da da. So this is literally the philosophy of the porch, because Zeno and Sidium and other followers would gather around a porch to discuss these ideas Zeno had. And by the time we get to Marcus Aurelius, because Zeno was around in BC of, I think, 300, 400. Do you have the date on top of mind?
Terrible with remembering exact dates, but...
But beforehand.
Doesn't particularly matter in this context, but... Yes.
And Marcus Aurelius, he never refers to Zeno, who is the founder of Stoicism, never says his name. He actually refers to later Stoics, and the biggest one, I believe, is Epicurus. Epicurus, and sorry if I'm saying that wrong, I'll make sure I correct that as I go further through notes. Epicetus, that is the word, that was the person, E-P-I-C-E-T-U-S, Epicetus. And so just wanted to give that context of, while Marcus Aurelius was writing this, he also took influence from philosophers outside of Stoicism. So Epicetus was a big influence, but so were others in other realms. So
he does reference Plato and Socrates in this as well.
Definitely. And Gregory Hayes says this. Gregory Hayes says, if you asked Marcus Aurelius what he was, he likely wouldn't say that he was a Stoic. He would likely say he's a philosopher. Or he was an admirer of philosophy, not Stoic label, even though this is what we see as Stoicism. This is kind of the... When we talk in the modern lingo of what Stoicism is, if anybody defined those terms quite a bit, it's a ton comes from this book.
Well, a big reason why I enjoyed this book in particular, in comparison to other Stoic readings, if you go back to other Stoics, it can kind of be a little nutty and a little, honestly, just not very useful. The reason why Marcus Aurelius, I think, is as famous for Stoicism is because he takes the Stoic idea of mastering oneself, excising the emotions, or not excising the emotions, but excising the weight you put in things you can't control. But he put that in a far more practical context of, I think he's mentioned several times in here, of I'm a practitioner of like Stoicism. I practice what I preach. It is a great shame that so many philosophers will think about something all the time, but ultimately never live their life and practice the philosophy that is preached. He does not. He's like, hey, I have things to do. I'm going to actually use this system of thought to make my life better.
If anybody was an admirer of philosophy, though, he was an admirer.
Yeah.
And he definitely went, when you kind of see, it's cool to see this, the mind of a man from almost 2,000 years ago, and see how a lot of the thoughts and ethical decision making we're the same humans, essentially.
Yeah.
These are still, a lot of the questions he's asking are still questions we ask ourselves. I mean, most of them. And focus on the ethics portion there, because there's...
Same monkeys, different wrenches.
Yes. there are three fundamentals to Stoicism. That's physics, ethics, and logic. And Aurelius leans into the ethical portion of this. Not really the physics. That mentions other things, but it is focused on how to make decisions, what actions to make, how to perceive things. And the three it comes down to that Gregory Hayes lays out, it's that there's three disciplines in that Marcus Aurelius lays out. It's perception, action, and will. Essentially, perception, how you view events, action is what we actually do, and will, what's not in our control.
What do you think was the most important of those three aspects? Like, what do you think he focused on the most?
All of them pretty equally, but perception stuck out a lot, because I think perception and how you treat the inner mechanisms of your mind was a focal point of this. And that was a focal point of philosophy back then too, because to just want to make one more point before getting into the book here, philosophy at the time was a way to design your life and to make ethical decisions, just a way to function. He wrote this and was writing these musings 160 to 100 AD. Christianity was very new, not as widespread. Religion in today's modern text can answer some of these questions, while philosophy in the time, in some way, from my understanding, I'm attributing just my thoughts here, philosophy seemed to be at the time a way to live your life in the same way religion would teach you that back in the day. So it seemed as if faith and philosophy were very different things when Marcus Aurelius was writing this. Did you take that as well, where it seemed as though, because religion in a lot of sense can be your, then takes place of that philosophy. Because if you're a Christian, if he was a Christian and a couple hundred years later lived in that world of Rome and the Roman Empire, that would have a lot of his answers.
Yeah, I mean, there's different, I mean, of course, from the beginning of history, different religions operate.
Yeah.
You know, the different sects, they have different value systems, different focuses.
Definitely.
For specifically the Romans, the gods, religion itself, like just faith in the gods themselves were not treated the same way that Christianity is. Of Christianity is a way of life. It is lessons that must be taught and things to do, what not to do. Like, there is a bit more of a philosophy and way to order your life with Christianity and many other religions, you know, Islam, Judaism, basically most of the namesake religions around today. But the Roman gods are not that.
What are the Greek and Roman gods doing? You know,
they are, I think, at best cautionary tales, but nobody really, like, people did believe in them, but there was not a, Zeus didn't, you know, tell you how to live your life. Neither did Poseidon. Like, it's, the gods were more of a reflection over, like, how humans saw Mother Nature and how they saw themselves. And, like, their inner society was a reflection in their gods. The fact that Zeus is, you know, this tyrant that every time he comes down to Earth, he lays just with, basically sleeps with anything that moves, and then is petty. And it's like that's more of a reflection of, like, how human beings at the time saw society itself. Not really a way to lead your life. So I philosophy don't know. Filled the niche.
Plenty of people look at Zeus as an inspiration. If I get to sleep with anybody,
that is true.
What?
That is a way of life.
You can't blame me. One of the gods is doing it. How many Romans and Greeks at the time you think just did that as a cop out? No, what would WWZD? What would Zeus do? Well,
what would Zeus do?
A lot of things, buddy.
Sleep with it. That's the answer. Everything. Inanimate object, animate objects, anything that could move. Zeus slept with it.
Lastly, you'll hear in this book the term logos used a lot. In a very simple way that helped when I was reading the book to what logos is, Gregory Hayes lays out for you. It's somewhat synonymous with nature or providence or God. And though that kind of cosmic level, it's what governs the universe, but it also operates in individuals as well. Logos kind of isn't that all-encompassing term. He often refers to that. So a lot to get into there. But now to get into the meat of meditations. What was your overall thoughts of your impression when you first read this book way back? What was your history with the book, Rich?
Well,
and what sticks with you?
History with it is I read this book, and we actually did a short, like, little 8-minute video essay type video for it. I actually still have my notes from that video, which was helpful for this one.
Nice.
But ultimately, I quite liked it. There's a lot of the lessons in the book were articulations of things that I kind of already knew about. But ultimately, I liked having the wording of the lessons that I've learned. And the basic stuff of, like, if you could take any lesson from it, is don't be so emotional about things. Don't let things get to you. If I wanted to boil down stoicism.
One takeaway.
To the barest of bones of, don't let it get to you. That's a lot of it. But to actually break it down even further and see the extremes of like how your mind is your, can either be your paradise or your prison. Make of that what you will. And ultimately you do have some control over your mind. If you have control over anything, it would be how you think about things, how you choose to interpret the things that happen in your life.
Mm-hmm.
I think is a very valuable thing to hear and to internalize. And so I liked that aspect of it a lot. And then putting into the action of like, why are we here? And mm-hmm. ultimately one of Marcus Aurelius' like purpose of getting up in the morning. Like if you struggle with purpose, one of the key purposes that makes us different than animals is working together. Like the cooperation with your fellow man is arguably chief nature's purpose. I kind of like that thought. And it does give context to like almost anything that you would set your purpose to, any kind of nuanced thing of like, if your purpose is to be a game developer, if your purpose is to be a novelist, if your purpose is to name a thing, ultimately it comes down to your cooperation or service for others. That's basically what all purposes are. And so kind of understanding that is a good focus to have. It's not like what you do, it's what you do for others.
This, a lot of what Marcus really says too, he is focused on the community and nature being one with this logos. And so your impressions going in beforehand was, hey, I already thought about a lot of this and kind of had these opinions. Now I have in words things that I agree with.
Yeah, I don't think the book like radically changed me, but
you were already radical to begin with. You were already friggin' lunatic. So
that's like, I don't even think this is particularly radical. Yeah. I just like, you know, the person who just kind of gets upset at every little thing of, you know, they get their order wrong in Applebee's and they kind of throw a hissy fit.
Not again, Martha.
Well, I've never been that. I can imagine if I was that type of person and I read Meditation, I'd just go, wow, you mean I don't have to throw my tray of tater tots at the waitress because I asked for curly fries? Mind blown. I was never that. So the book is not as dramatic to me.
Gotcha.
But I could see a lot of people needing to hear these things.
Yeah, going into the book for me, I had this very pop culture understanding of Stoicism or Meditations. From obviously, you read the book and we just talked about it and I kind of got some snippets there. But also, even before that, okay, you get this rudimentary knowledge of Stoicism or what's in Meditations is do what's in your control. Handle that. What's outside your control, don't worry about it. To be very rudimentary, but we're going to get into the weeds of all that, and we have lots of quotes to go over and actual themes of what Aurelius is getting at. But what I found when actually reading the book is I am nodding my head with so much of this in the conclusions and going, yes, yes, yes. But I think I found some things in his logic that was contradictory, which will be more fun to talk about because I found, obviously, he's not writing this as a thesis as well. These are just
All good religion and philosophy is contradictory.
Exactly, yeah.
You can't have a good philosophy without contradictions.
But that kept me from being, I guess, because when you're reading this book and you leave it going, hey, are you a Stoic? Would you read this and go, you are a Stoic, or you admire some of the Stoic philosophy? How would you categorize yourself? I'm just curious because we finally get to dive into philosophy.
This is great. Wonderful.
This is our forte.
I would say, one, I find it strange, especially after reading this book. There's a reason why Marcus Aurelius doesn't like outwardly call himself, I am a Stoic. There is something anti-Stoic about calling yourself a Stoic. Especially how Marcus Aurelius puts it, of it is just a way of being. It's just a focus on your purpose in life and excising the distractions and vices and all the things that you cannot control. Ultimately, creating a label and having a society, which there is an actual Stoic society, which I find weird. I don't know. Like, you don't need a Stoic society.
Your cousin's a part of that, right?
Yeah. Yeah. She saw our video. Hi, cousin. If you're watching, I don't know.
She is it she? He?
she?
She probably watches all the meditation stuff, so she's definitely watching
it. She's there. Anyway, I don't know. There's nothing wrong with having Stoic society, but I wouldn't call myself a Stoic, really.
Gotcha.
But I agree with a lot of the messages and themes, and it's many of the aspects I practice in my own life.
Yeah, and good clarification again, just to repeat. This is modern understanding of Stoicism, so we're going to attribute Stoicism and meditations. We're going to conflate those
and
terms.
They aren't
even though
exactly
they're
exactly the same. You know, you'll see someone who's like, hey, Marcus Aurelius isn't like true Stoicism. You don't define it. It's like, fair enough. This is his brand or our image of Stoicism as practiced by Marcus Aurelius.
Yeah. And he definitely, again, is inspired by a lot of the Stoics because you can look at different forms. And if you Google Stoicism, you'll get a certain definition as well. This is Marcus Aurelius. We're reacting to his thoughts. Yeah. I'm going to conflate that with Stoicism a lot here. So, yeah, a lot of big themes. Want to talk about one theme here, and we'll get to, I think the more fun conversation will be on just I want to pick your brain on this contradiction that I think is in his logic here. But first, want to talk about themes and break down those.
Sure.
One theme to talk about is just how, I don't know how to label this other than don't let others negatively impact you, or just how his perception of outside of yourself, how you should conduct yourself and your mind when it comes to other people's actions. What are some of the big themes you got from that?
Well, especially in this book, it's not so black and white. Mm-hmm. I believe he even does mention that, you know, the opinions of people that he does respect matters to him. Those kind of like, it's not all just self-isolation of don't care about what anyone thinks about. Like, don't anyone outside of your own head, like, disregard their opinions. It's like, no, you disregard the opinions of people that, one, are, you know, not important to you, not close to you, don't have your best intentions at heart, like, all these things. But, you know, someone very close to you, a mentor figure, you should care about what they
think.
Here's
a quote from the text to support you there. He says, when you need encouragement, think of the qualities the people around you have. This one's energy, this one's modesty, another's generosity, and so on. Nothing is as encouraging as when virtues are visibly embodied in the people around us when we're practically showered with them. If you see somebody else that's honorable, oh, cool, I want to be around other honorable people.
Yeah. And so, I mean, that's a lesson that's not exclusive to Stoicism. I think almost every parent has told their kid of, like, you know, don't take the teasing too hard, of, like, you know, don't, you know, in response to, like, hey, that person said mean things about me, it's like, well, generally ignore it. Like, it's okay. You don't need to internalize someone else's mean words about you. It doesn't define you.
In the social media age especially, and this is why you see so many people quoting Aurelius on Instagram or wherever you might see. Here's one quote to emphasize this point. He says, yes, keep degrading yourself, soul, but soon your chance at dignity will be gone. Everyone gets one life. Yours is almost used up. And instead of treating yourself with respect, you have entrusted your own happiness in the soul of others. Mm-hmm. Just emphasizing this point of why entrust your happiness in other people? Why are you degrading yourself based on what somebody else thinks of you? And here's another point where he says, don't waste the rest of your time here worrying about other people unless it affects the common good. And there's plenty of other portions of his writings here where he talks about a crowd clapping for you or all the wealth you can get in the world. And he emphasizes this point by saying the empty I'm not going to say the whole context, but the emptiness of all those applauding hands, the people who praise us, how capricious they are, how arbitrary.
Which I think does lean into as well his perception on the world of, he mentions a few times, several times in here of, remember your place on the earth, on how many people came before you and how many people will come after, that every experience that you have, that you feel this deep personal individual connection to, remember that, you know, billions have gone through in the course of history, have gone through the exact same thing. And so the whole idea of us being just a speck on the timeline of history, that even, you know, the Roman emperor is a tiny fraction of importance in the grand scale of things. keeping that in mind, and then you see the adoring crowd, like the clapping, the adoration, or even the disdain of crowds is like, this is not that meaningful. It is not that significant to put all your stock into.
What do you think about the point he makes where he says, if you've lived 40 years or 1,000, it's no difference. You've seen all, what more is there to see for living another 1,000 years? That history repeats itself. Nations come and go. He has this repetition where he makes that point clear. Do you tend to agree with him?
You could be true. Like, one thing can be true and then ultimately not as serving. Like, there's a focus to it. I think that generally, yes. Like, history does tend to rhyme. It tends to, you know, human experiences are not as unique as we might like to think. You know, everyone goes through losing a loved one, even though it's always incredibly personal to us. Everyone will eventually go through it and go through it multiple times. It's not a unique human experience. Same thing with name a tragedy. Other people have gone through it. And so it takes some of the isolation out of it and the individual importance, and more, this is just one of the human experiences that's all kind of on repeat, but ultimately not very useful. Like, there's a lot of things, like, it is important to change, like, believe in things, try to change the world for the better if you can. And so you can't believe that nothing matters.
Which he certainly is not a nihilist.
No.
He does not believe nothing matters. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is the nice focus, is like, all the things that you cannot control, don't put your energy into it. The things that matter is the stuff that you can change. Which is important.
That is. That kind of gets me to the contradiction point. I can bring this up now, then we can go back. Because this is the one thing with the logic. I got into a rabbit hole with all of this. But this is based on both Gregory Hayes. He kind of added some context into this because he helps explain Marcus Aurelius and Stoic philosophy as well. But basically this is the way Aurelius views the world and the logos, etc., is a compatibilist, which for viewers, it's basically free will and determinism are two opposite ends of the spectrum where, hey, if you have free will, you feel that you have free choice over your actions. Sorry, being reductionist, but you have freedom to choose what you want to do and control over your life. And determinism means that all of your actions are predetermined, because whether your environment, your biology, et cetera, everything was designed in a way that was a decision that had to be made no matter what.
That ultimately every action of yours comes down to generally chemicals, and like you wanting to want something is predetermined in your biology, your diet, your upbringing, your name a thing, but ultimately not you.
Right. And where Aurelius lands is somewhere in compatibilism, where compatibilists think that free will and determinism can coexist. In a sense. Hmm. Now, what would Aurelius define as free will? A bit of different definitions, especially because he wasn't saying these terms at the time as well. So this is a bit of using modern philosophy and trying to translate over time. But this is why I'm curious what you think, because throughout the book, he is very indifferent in how when explaining other people's actions and what other people do and their evils, it's very understanding and going, well, they were determined to do that. Nature itself caused them to do this. The logos did. And I can give some quotes to give this just so people have some context. I'll get into quotes. But he essentially says other people, they were bound to do this. If you just understand what is their version of good and evil, well, you shouldn't expect otherwise. Nature in itself wills it. But then when it comes to his own decision-making, he is able to then feels that you yourself are morally responsible for the decisions you make, but doesn't extend that responsibility to others as far as how you should internalize it. And Gregory Hayes in the beginning here has a great analogy, which I thought was great, but then I have a counterpoint to that analogy, where Gregory Hayes says, all events are determined by the logos and follow in an unbreakable chain of cause and effect. Stoicism is thus, from the outset, a deterministic system that appears to leave no room for human free will or moral responsibility. In reality, the Stoics were reluctant to accept such an arrangement and attempted to get around the difficulty by defining free will as voluntary accommodation to what is any case inevitable. According to this theory, man is like a dog tied to a moving wagon. If the dog refuses to run along with the wagon, he will be dragged by it, yet the choice remains his, to run or to be dragged. In the same way, humans are responsible for their choices and actions, even though these have been anticipated by the Logos and form part of this its plan. Even actions which appear to be, and indeed are, immoral or unjust advance the overall design, which taken as a whole is a harmonious and good, they too are governed by the Logos. But essentially, I like that analogy of the way kind of viewing this world of you're getting dragged by a wagon. Do you want to just be dragged by it or stand up and walk with the wagon? Which my counterpoint to that kind of analogy of this kind of thinking is, well, wouldn't your decision to walk or be dragged by it also be determined in a sense? Because it seems that the logic Aurelius is going off of is that nature and logos is already determined, and you can internalize in your mind, and basically you have to accept your purpose, and the most satisfactory life is doing what you were born to do, your will, and be one with nature. You were always meant to do this thing and this action. It's just you need to accept it in that way. You need to find your purpose and your place in this grand logos. And so that what he seems to say, and I'll give, sorry, two quotes, and I just wanted to make the point so that we could discuss it. Like, here's a quote to say the things that happen to you and how others act, and then I'll counterpoint that with what Marcus Aurelius says himself can do. Okay, so here's this quote. When you have to deal with someone, ask yourself, what does he mean by good and bad? If he thinks X or Y by pleasure and pain and what produces them, about fame and disgrace and about death and life, then it shouldn't shock or surprise you when he does X or Y. And here's the important part about that. In fact, I'll remind myself that he has no real choice. So when Aurelius is talking about other people, it's as if they don't have this choice because, you know, fated to do so. But then when talking about himself, obviously says, hey, I can still make the decision to feel affection for people, da-da-da. They haven't diminished your ability to choose. Other quotes such as, nothing has meaning to my mind except its own actions, which are within its own control, and it's only the immediate ones that matter. Its past and future actions are too meaningless, etc. Anyways, this compatible way of he combines free will and determinism, that saying things in use for universe are determined except how your mind perceives things you have control over. But then to the point of that,
apply that to others.
Apply that to others. Why only apply it to yourself and not others? Also, there's I don't agree with all of his philosophy, but it's important to bring up this quote because it's big. But Sam Harris, he's an atheist who, this is not in response to Aurelius, but he says this to compatibilists of that who try to combine free will and determinism. And he says, from my point of view, compatibilism is a little like saying a puppet is free so long as it loves its strings. And that's, I kind of really agree with that, of at least with his logic here, it's like your things are predetermined as long as you are doing what you're supposed to be doing and what has already been created in the universe. You are okay as long as you love the strings of the puppetry of the logos of the universe. So why does he apply that moral responsibility to himself, but then not others? Anyways, that is the whole thought process of just, I was going down a rabbit hole, and I just need to know what you think about all this.
One in nature, I do want to touch on the end there first and then work our way back.
Yes, go in.
I think there is frequently the idea of freedom itself, just the term freedom means very different things to other people in a legal context, in a moral context, in, you know, cosmic realities.
Yeah.
I do think it is incorrect, or at least not how I view freedom and chaos being synonymous. Of if you're not free to, you know, break the rules of reality, that means that you are, you know, in chains. I'm not, I wouldn't say that. I think ultimately you can have freedom within the framework of reality, that there are boundaries around everything, boundaries of physics and life. There's boundaries within society, and yet you can still be free. That is not, those aren't exclusive things. As long as you're not, you know, complete chaos, it doesn't mean you're not free. That's one thing. So I would say,
I follow, yeah,
to some degree, it is a derogatory, or like it is a negative analogy of, so long as you love the strings, so long as the puppet loves their strings. However, I don't think it's completely inaccurate. Of like, I would probably agree with that. Of like, yes, if you would, if I consider the strings of, you know, our reality, our society, our, but I would still consider myself, I have freedom within my, the boundaries of life. Fair enough. Anyway, that's my point. Mm-hmm. I would say you can have freedom and order. Those are not opposite terms.
What about free will and determinism?
Yeah, for this one specifically, I think Marcus Aurelius is going on how, specifically how you perceive others. It is not useful to perceive others in the same way that you perceive yourself. In that, so his quote here of limit good and bad to our own actions, and to when someone does something that is like, hey, that how they grew up, the cause and effect, like that's who they are. That's more in the sense of you can't control their own actions. There's no point. There's no point to try and like think outside your head, own your own head of like their actions are theirs. Them doing bad things, of course, because they have led to all these things. So I see it more as a perception rather than him applying a different standard to himself than others.
Just a quick counterpoint to that, because that important quote there of when he's saying, hey, when someone does X or Y, pleasure or pain, about mm-hmm. life and death, he says, in fact, I'll remind myself that he has no real choice, meaning that person has no choice over what they did because of they were determined by their mental logic that they did that regardless.
Well, it's more of one of the lessons that Marcus Aurelius talks about is one of man's purpose is to resist vice and resist temptation. And I think that is in line of like, as human beings, we are led toward, we have these urges, tendencies toward a variety of different impulses. And ultimately, that's not their fault. Like you having a desire for violence, you having a desire for lust, greed, all of these different aspects that every human experiences, is not their fault. It's not their fault that they desire that. But for yourself, you have a responsibility to resist as best you can. And so for Marcus Aurelius, like that's I would say he would probably acknowledge he has also those same desires, urges, all those things to fight. It is his responsibility to resist it. But it's important to have, you know, the mercy and recognition of others of like, it's not like they chose to have that greedy desire or that, you know, they chose to have the, you know, heart of violence. That was determined. They have failed to resist, but that's not their choice.
I 100% agree with the fruits and with the conclusions. I'm 100% on board. But if we're to take that logic and go, if it wasn't their choice, how was it your choice to be virtuous? It's all I'm saying is that the free will and determinism, how can they coexist where they were determined to make that bad choice? Then why is it not predetermined for you to be virtuous is my point. Because didn't you think yourself into making a good decision? Would in fact then predetermine if you're going to apply that same standard to the person who had no choice but to fall into despair, then you had no choice but to be virtuous. It's essentially saying that just apply that standard of they were put in that spot of they didn't want to have these desires. If you broke out of these desires, well, you were always meant to do that. So just like the analogy used about the wagon dragging you and you either stand and walk with it or just be dragged. Just my addition onto that analogy is it's not, I wouldn't arrange it like that because if we're to take Aurelius's logic with how nature and logos is designed and people are determined to make these actions, then even your decision to walk or be dragged would be in fact predetermined. If you just extend that logic once more, instead of contradicting as if you and your mind has this ability to break out of this deterministic chain. That's my only contention is that it's either free will exists or determinism exists. You can't conflate the two as if in your own head you can logic and wrap around the and break out of that deterministic chain. That's my point.
I think it's the nature of what is the default.
Yeah.
Like, man has no choice on his desires, but you do have a choice on how you resist. Now, it's possible that you fail at that, but it's not, it is also not your fault to say like, oh, he is evil in their heart of like, that's, they made the choice to be evil. It's maybe a more courteous or more merciful view of like, they failed at being good, which is different. I think a failure to change, a failure to stand up and walk with the cart is not the same as choosing to be dragged. Do you kind of get what I mean? Of it's not like, it is a choice to change and to break your conditioning, but it's not necessarily also a choice to be in that situation.
But his thing is, every action you do is also in a way predetermined, is the way I'm viewing what he's saying. Because it, okay, here's another thing where he says, something happens to you, good. It was meant for you by nature, woven into the pattern from the beginning. Basically, everything that ever happens to you in your entire life was meant to happen. It was fate. It was destiny. It was, this person did this to you. This thunderstorm did this to your house. Whatever happened to you.
Oh, I didn't even see that way at all. I saw it more as like, the things that happen to you are determined in the same sense of, you know, cause and effect, and actions have actions having consequences.
Well, that's what,
but that's ultimately like, you are a part of it. Like, your actions directly can have a cause of like, how your own life is affected, but so do other things.
Oh, I see. I don't think that's what he's saying though. Explain, maybe I'm misunderstanding. Yeah.
It's not necessarily of like, oh, it was fate. It was always determined. It was always it was always to be, in the sense of the rules of the universe of cause and effect, of if you have done something and then you get a certain reaction, it's like, yeah, that was always going to be because you have done the thing.
Here's a quote from that portion. He says, whatever happens to you has been waiting to happen since the beginning of time. The twinning strands of fate wove both of them together, your own existence and the things that happened to you.
Mm-hmm.
In that sense of, yeah, that everything was always meant to happen to you.
Yeah.
Mm. So how would you interpret that phrase, or just how, because he is saying essentially fate, it's again that fate deterministic, how can that exist if your own decisions could change? What he's getting at, I don't think Aurelius would say that you could change fate. You cannot.
Yeah.
Aurelius's position would be like, no, things were always meant to happen. You cannot change what happens. It's all about you just need to perceive with your mind, like the puppet on a string, of you just need to accept what nature has done and what fate has done.
That and is true, and his perception. When things happen to you, you accept it as they are.
Yeah, yeah.
One, because what else are you going to do?
Yeah.
Like, you accept reality as it is.
Right.
There's nothing, if you can't but change that, it, don't.
Yes. But then get to that next level of, he's obviously saying for your mind, why I like the conclusion parts of like, mm-hmm. these takes away, why I think if you take away some of the lessons here of, I do agree with, hey, don't let what other people say affect you, you know, don't let this rile you up and throw those tater tots everywhere over the supermarket. But he then goes the layer of when it comes to ethics. And then he's saying, well, even though this is all meant to happen and how you perceive things, you still have this control and are morally responsible, yet nature also determined this. So how can you both be morally responsible for things that are determined? If you get what I mean, of just that, I'm trying to logic around here how, not the merits of what he's saying, not the merits of whether it's a good message or bad, because a lot of this is just good stuff to mm-hmm. believe in. It's the premise of
applying a moral responsibility to yourself and not to others.
That, and also just, I don't think compatibilism logically follows. I see it as black or white, where it's free will exists or determinism exists. They can't both. Like, in what logic can they both exist? Also, if you also agree with the premise of my reading here, of this is kind of what he's getting at, because I really tried to go in the weeds of see what others have said online. I've watched videos of like with 300 views on YouTube, because there's not a lot with this specific question being asked in mind. And trying to find what Stoics actually believe about this as well. And it seems like that it comes back to the answer of hey, the wagon and the being dragged and how you decide to. And it, if that is the decision, if life is the wagon just dragging you and it's stand up or drag along, it just comes back to that Sam Harris statement of, from my point of view, compatibilism is little like saying a puppet is free so long as it loves its strings.
There's some truth to it in its extremes, and then you start getting grayer when it comes to smaller decisions of, like, you have no choice on whether you die or not.
Of course. You will die.
Is that, like...
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Coverage varies by plan. View contracts and exclusions at endurancewarranty.com.
If you're driving a car or truck with an expired warranty and suddenly lost your transmission or needed a full engine repair, would a $4,000 repair bill leave you stranded? I'm Danica Patrick. Don't get caught off guard with a vehicle breakdown. Choose the company I trust, Endurance. No matter the mileage, if your vehicle is less than 20 years old, Endurance offers comprehensive auto protection plans for any budget. Protection on the drivetrain, electrical, transmission, AC, and more. Plus, benefits like 24/7 roadside assistance and rental car reimbursement on any plan. Endurance handles everything from making the claim through the repair process to paying the certified mechanic of your choice. Don't get caught off guard with a vehicle breakdown. Act now and get one full year of elite benefits, a $2,000 value, free.
Visit endurancewarranty.com for your fast free quote today. That's endurancewarranty.com.
That is out of your control. That is a thing that will happen to you. Is that fate? Is it fate right. that you will die?
Right.
I wouldn't say you would even, it's almost wrong to even say it that way, but in a way, yes.
Mm-hmm.
The fate has determined that you will die. Duh.
Yeah.
Everyone dies.
Well, spoilers. What the hell?
You know, so fate has determined that you will, like, if you are born, fate has determined that you will be born because it is, proof is. Fate often is just kind of looked in, like, reverse of, if it has happened, it's proof that it was always meant to happen, because
which is why determinism is so hard to counter, because, like, well, I can't disprove it.
Yeah.
It already happened, yeah.
But then you go one step further. It's more of a, once it is already done, it is all, like, it's as things should be. Because that was also something with a lot of what he was talking about with perception, is everything that does happen is good. Because, like, that's the extreme that where, like, I would probably disagree of, like, everything that happens to you, everything that ever happens and is natural is good. And so even if you're gravely maimed, if you're tortured, all these things is good because it has happened. It's more of, like, looking back of, if as long as it exists, good. So
I don't really know. What this seems is priming your mind to accept the inevitabilities.
Yeah.
That's what a lot of what the full this thinking is.
All those extremes are true of accept your death, accept the fact that you were born and alive, and that, yes, you were not, did not choose to be born, but you are. You are here. And now that you are here, you have a responsibility to your fellow man, and you have all of these things to do. And you might as well, and, like, there are rules to follow. You're born into society, and, like, there are laws that you have to follow. You didn't choose to be born in that and choose to follow the guidelines of society, but here you are. And so you're not free, but you have a choice to follow.
But what choice do you have is my question.
In your own head, you have a choice to complain or you have a choice to accept it.
However, that choice to complain or accept it, is that predetermined? or do you have the will to do that? Because he'd argue that you have the will to do, everything is determined except your, this is where the contradiction comes into play. Everything is determined. Things are always meant to happen except my perception of how the determined things are going to happen in his head. So it's, if you, again, then my next step to that would be, well, if you perceive things with a better light of if you do accept death and you have all these virtuous things, which is aligning with nature, as Aurelius would say, you're doing all the correct things that would be virtuous and honorable and you'd be morally responsible, etc. If you're doing all of that, how is that also not determined? Just kind of going back into that cycle of, well, of course you do that because, well, this was always meant to happen because that person did this to you, this did this to you, and of course you thought that because of your upbringing and da-da-da. It just seems like he's trying to find will in a deterministic system and just be the puppet on the string. So I guess that's my, where I see it as a contradiction. Now, obviously, he's not writing this as a narrative and a thesis statement to go, hey, this is what you... He's talking to himself.
It's far more of a practical ideology of, like, remembering that, again, when not to be dramatically upset at others' actions.
Great
when
message.
It's, like, going, like, look, they're human beings. They were, like, remember their upbringing in life. Like, ultimately, it is a type of mercy to have for others and understanding, like, people have their circumstances, people have these desires, people have faults and failings and all these things, and to remember that they didn't make an active choice to be where they are. Ultimately, no one has made, like, where they are is not purely active choice, and that's a thing to remember for others. But then for yourself, it's accepting those aspects and then anything that you do have control over to do your best in. And that is the what you have responsibility for, is any small amount of things in the world that you have control over. That's what you are responsible for. You're not responsible for the choices of others. That's not your responsibility to, and that ultimately good and evil should be limited to your own control and your own actions and your own thoughts.
Yeah.
Which is far more practical.
Again, if that control didn't have a contradiction, I like that conclusion, especially where he says, hey, be hard on oneself, but indulgent to others, like the Spartans giving shade to their guests. Of course, I love that message of, like, yeah, I love being hard on myself and you, and then completely forgiving of others, because that is a good way to live and treat your guests kindly and give them benefit of the doubt. And mercy, I guess mercy as a good virtue as well, to a point, though.
Hey, look, it's more about the hate in your heart and, like, going, like, why can't they think this way? It's more of, like, it's not to say, oh, that person murdered someone, oh, it's not their fault and let them off. No, punish them. They still, like, rule and law. Law and order still matters. It's not, but it's more of a internally in your head, don't put this great anguish on, like, mental weight on, oh, they did this horrible, evil thing, and it was like, they made that active decision to be in the place that they are. It's like, yeah, not completely. So, yeah, you're right. Seems like a contradiction to me. I mean, ultimately, the difference between free will and, you know, determinism is the soul. You can't have free will without a soul. That's ultimately it.
How would you define soul too?
An essence outside of our physical reality that makes us who we are. Mm.
So essentially more of the religious sense of a soul, or just spiritual does not have to be religious or spiritual.
No,
at all.
But yeah. Something beyond the chemical, something beyond the atoms pushing atoms along.
Because if it's all just atoms, which actually he mentioned several times atoms in the book. Mm-hmm. I didn't even realize we had somewhat of a concept of atoms.
Oh, yeah.
At the time, which I was like, whoa, we not the
Human
understanding
beings,
we have now.
Smart. Yeah.
not, I don't think it was proven we had atoms. It was just a term they used, and some Greek philosophers understood basic. Yeah.
Well, no, they theorized they basically theorize the idea of, like, the basic building blocks of life.
Yeah.
Which are atoms. Like, they couldn't see it with a microscope. They didn't have microscopes, but
they figured it out.
They have the term we still use today, and they were right. That's so,
I so again, all these going over some more of the teachings, self-teachings, again, musings that he said to himself, can be really inspirational. You can look at community, which you mentioned earlier. He mentioned what injures the hive injures the bee. And he also says, if it does not harm the community, it does not harm its members. He's very focused on, as well, community and looking at just outside of yourself. A lot of this, what's kind of admirable about it, forget that the whole conversation we had aside, because I'm just going to have the contradiction in mind of just, I don't think it fits. Put that aside just to appreciate the conclusion stuff, where some I agree with, some I don't. One thing to look at to admire is a lot of this comes across as very selfless. He is very self-reflective, and it's obvious to look at as he's writing this, as flawed of a man as he was, who knows what the actual history, but just you look at somebody that thinks this deeply and is trying to get outside yourself and find a way to not blame others or to be more hard on yourself is an admirable quality. When you look at somebody that does that,
it's a very, maybe it's wrong to say common, but a good trope in storytelling is if a character is asking themselves, am I a good person? Am I a good man? That necessarily.
Sun Eater.
But plenty of others.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Plenty.
That in and of itself is kind of evidence to they are probably, if not ultimately good, they're not evil. Like, yeah. If you are questioning yourself, like, that's along this lines of, like, that's a good person trait.
They're at least an anti-hero.
But yes, the fact that Marcus Aurelius was musing and considering and putting a lot of thought into what it would mean to be a good person, what it would mean to be a good leader, a human being in his society, and what his role and purpose is.
Right.
And that ultimately his finds is, my purpose is for the community. My purpose is to my fellow man. Generally is, you know, it's at least not selfish. It's at least not entirely self-serving. It's good aims.
Definitely agreed. And this quote, so I'm trying to use a lot of quotes because he'll say it better than we can explain his words. He says, it's quite possible to be a good man without anyone realizing it. I thought that's an important part to go.
I have that.
It emphasizes that point that he's not looking for the applause or shouldn't see that as the goal, wealth, applause, but it is quite possibly a good man without anyone realizing it. And he also says, fully embrace the pursuit that you embarked on. And I'm saying those quotes together, and one more, this will all make sense. He says, if you seek tranquility, do less, do less better. That encapsulates this kind of, I don't want to say happiness, maybe satisfaction or fulfillment's a better word, but he has this theme of talking about putting your all into something and not spreading yourself too thin, where he says, if you seek tranquility, do less better. Kind of make a decision, do the thing that you set out to do, what your purpose is, find out what that purpose is and what you're meant to do in logos, nature, etc. What God, providence ordained to, this is the thing that you ought to do and to be a virtuous person. And do that despite others' applause or despite if people would applaud you or boo you, you should still do that thing. And to do it better, choose or focus down, niche. Instead of having a YouTube channel on movies and books, just do books. You know, just niche it down. What did God want us to do? Probably not this. Are we wasting our time? I don't know.
Yes. However,
give me the however. What's the positive?
If our purpose is to serve others, and if people watch or listen to the things we put on the internet and gain some type of value out of it, we are in some way serving others.
Ah.
I mean, that's the point of
community. That was a self-serving way of saying that. I like that. I like that. Comes right back.
It comes right back around. But no, it is true. If what you do is in the service of others and not, you know, entirely just about extracting the value from other people, but you are trying to give value and serve your community, that you're generally on the right path. You're probably not doing anything too bad.
We sometimes like to extract $10 a month for the book club and provide, hey, if you want to discuss books like Meditations in our book club, you can join that in the link in the description, where we have a book club community.
Yeah.
So we provide, but do we it's about how much do you provide versus take? What makes a good man and what is the right balance? But I do want to say on the side, we love what we do here. I mean, even regardless of, hey, we were doing this with 5 viewers, we're doing it with this many viewers. But I will say there was a certain point where if it didn't hit some traction, why post it on the internet?
Well, so it would mean
you want to provide some value to a community.
It would mean the community does not, the community at large does not value what you are doing for them. And so ultimately, find something better.
With a better purpose.
With a better purpose. Find a better purpose that will better serve the people around you. But I did have a good quote. So in this whole idea, because this kind of does center around a lot of what we were talking about, of kind of the contradiction, but personally is kind of my answer to nihilism, even if it isn't maybe logically consistent. Mm-hmm. But what he said is, honor and revere the gods. Treat human beings as they deserve. Be tolerant with others and strict with yourself. Mm-hmm. Remember, nothing belongs to you but your flesh and blood, and nothing else is under your control. I think that ultimately is like, if you're looking at it purely internally of like, if the only thing under my control is my own flesh and blood and what my decisions with it, than other people's decisions, in a weird way, yes, in their own head, that also is the only thing they control. But they are outside of my own body.
What's your
perception?
They don't
have exactly. But the point is, it's focused on my perception. Mm-hmm. Your actions are beyond my control, and therefore, I should be tolerant, because it's not. It's beyond my control. It's therefore, it's part of the universe. Even though if I were to then go into your body, it would be like, now it is your turn. But to kind of go what I mean, it is very much individually perception of like, it does. It is not a universal philosophy of like, it applies to everyone and treat everyone kind of the same. It is narrow.
And I like how it's consistent throughout his perception of time and death. And so how you should treat others. And he also looks at time. In this very, I really like how he framed it, looking at the past, present, or future, where he says the past and future don't exist. They are not real. The present is the only thing that is actually real. Kind of that hyper-focus into what can you do now? What are you doing right now? And he said it in a smarter way that I'm going to try to, here's one of the smaller quote here. He says, you can't lose either the past or future. How could you lose what you don't have? And you think, oh, the future is what you plan for. And obviously a response to Marcus Aurelius here could be like, oh, what about college funds? Don't you have to think about investing and all these important things that you got to plan for a future? We know he means it more in the mindset of, how could you lose what you don't have? Be focused on what you're doing in the present. Be focused on the actions you're making, your perception in the present. That is the focal point.
And it's not, your actions that are totally relevant to the moment. No, when you are present, you are also considering what actions today will help me in the future and will make, you are looking to the future, but ultimately you're not living there. Like, it's not
real.
I will do this thing later. It's more, no, what can I do now to get what I want later?
And I'd say you probably go extreme and just be literally, how literal do you take him there when he says the past and future don't exist? I think that's a way of him wording this into being, hey, focus.
Yeah, extreme, sure.
But yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, the fact that it's the past and the way he says it doesn't exist of like, you can't lose it. Like, you have not lost your past because like, you don't own it. It is not, it's just, it is like the past is,
it was Adam's.
It's
Timmy's
not real.
Dog that died.
It's not technically real. It's just what was, it's not a thing to change. It's not a thing to take hold of and possess. It's nothing real like a book or anything. It is just what has happened.
Right.
You can't lose it. You can't gain it.
And just where it comes into
the future.
Yeah, that comes in with his philosophy of just accepting death at a certain point and how you should perceive how you should perceive death and how you should perceive when you die. He has a cool analogy that made me really think about this. He says, since we live in such a small moment, okay. Suppose that a god announced that you are going to die tomorrow or the day after. Unless you were a complete coward, you wouldn't kick up a fuss about which day it was. What difference would it make? Now, recognize that the difference between years from now and tomorrow is just as small. I thought that was a good way of putting it where, hey, if God comes down to you, Rich, and says, either this Thursday or Friday you're dying, you're not going like, God, I need Friday. What? Give me 12 more hours. It's such an arbitrary amount because you're going, oh, you're dying soon.
Yeah.
And he's saying extend that instead of it's either you're going to die this Friday or you're going to die 30 years from now. That's a big difference. You should probably care about that. However, Aurelius is saying that you should view that amount of time as the same. Again, is that a way that I'm practically going to actually think about things in my life? Probably not. I'm going to be honest. I can't wrap my head. I can't logic my way into going like, oh, Friday or 30 years from now, no difference. I can't get to that, but I get the point he's making of look at time as very fleeting and look at how small and microscopic and small our time in this grand scheme of events in the universe is really nothing.
You can take the more nihilistic way of it's so little, it's so nothing that you might as like it's worth nothing or it's worth everything. Take it what you will. I would lean on the side of time is so fleeting and is our time on this earth is so minuscule that it is infinitely valuable.
Aurelius says, in short, know this. Human lives are brief and trivial. Yesterday, a blob of semen. Tomorrow, embalming fluid, ash. Where do you think he takes this? he says human lives are brief and trivial. How do you take that?
I mean, in the grand scheme of things, of like just trying... Because again, this is more the perception of trying to minimize the tragedies and the things around you that you don't have control over, remembering that it is nothing in the grand scheme of things, that human lives like come and go. It is even your own death is just one among many in like the actual, you know, billions.
Is Aurelius without logos a nihilist? Essentially,
probably
right. You take away that ordain, that providence, that God, and that's what.
Yeah, I mean, you're basically trying to be ultimately nihilist about everything that is not directly under your control, and it's a way to better suffer the pains of life. That when you, I look at us when you're talking about that human life is so trivial and fleeting. The way you look at that is when you have a close personal connection, someone close to you dies, mm-hmm. you can wallow in it, and there's you can experience it like and feels like it is the only thing that has ever happened to you, and that this is unique to you, or you bring wider context to alleviate some of that pain is realizing that this has happened to everyone else and it will happen to you. And I think that does make it a little bit better of realizing that death is something everyone experiences does minimalize it, even if we always feel it's personal.
He gives examples of those deaths saying, Heraclitus often told us the world would end in fire, but it was moisture that carried him off. He died smeared in cow shit. Democritus was killed by ordinary vermin. Socrates by humankind. And? You boarded. You set sail. You've made the passage. Time to disembark. If it's for another life, well, there's nowhere without gods on that side either. If to nothingness, then you no longer have to put up with the pain and pleasure, or go on dancing attendance on this battered crate. Your body, so much inferior to that which it serves it.
Basically adding on to, you don't have control over it, so why do you care?
Right. And this entire focal point he's making about death, by the way, I don't know how much to attribute this to the translation as well versus Aurelius, but these are some awesome lines. These are, I mean, going back to some of these, just, oh yeah, yesterday a blob of semen, tomorrow embalming fluid. Ash. The way it's
reading the other translation,
not as cool.
Gotta give it to Gregory Hayes. He does a good job of to our lingo and using idioms that apply today. Which, hey, you would say, hey, it's not as accurate. Maybe. But also is maybe more understandable to the ideas. So who knows? I actually have a good one as well.
Oh, go for it.
This is kind of in evidence to what you were talking about before. It is crazy to want what is impossible, and impossible for the wicked not to do so.
Right.
You know, these are, bunch of banger lines. I like that. That's a hard line. But, you know, not to assume it's impossible because you find it hard, but to recognize that if it's humanly possible, you can do it too.
Good line.
No, plenty of great quotes in here, and I do give a lot of credit here to Gregory Hayes himself.
Awesome. There are some cool nuggets here. You mentioned this way earlier in the episode about how he opens one of the books, which, again, just he finished one scroll, started the next, or this could have been changed over time, just whoever translated it and lost the time. So one of them starts with him wanting to wake up in the morning and putting himself in the mindset of, what are you doing, bitch, is what he says to himself, of get up.
Yeah.
Don't be lazy. You have a purpose. Go make the step outside of bed. And that was cool to see, because 2,000 years later, people still struggle getting out of bed. And it's funny to see an emperor of Rome writing and musing to himself, come on, do what Logos demands you. We demand
Marcus Aurelius, you got to clean your room.
That's exactly what he's saying. Yeah. Get off your ass and do something about it. And so seeing that humanized him a ton for me. And the second thing that humanized him a ton, I wouldn't even thought this was in here. I don't know how often this is referenced, but there's a snippet in there where he mentions that you should think pure thoughts always think pure thoughts, for the pure reason that when someone asks you, what are you thinking about, you can answer them honestly. And that humanized them in a way, because obviously, you know, when you just, your mind goes down to train of thoughts and then somebody asks, oh, what are you thinking about? And you go, I can't actually say what the fuck my messed up brain was thinking about. How do I explain that I was doing this? But he must have had thoughts in his head that, you know, just like any normal human does, just went down a rabbit hole, was thinking something. You're jealous. You're whatever goes on in your head. And someone goes, oh, what do you think about Marcus? And he's like, nothing, Becky. But that also humanized him in a way where a lot of these things are just, it's human nature.
Yeah. I mean, it's also in this similar vein to the lazy person's reason why not to lie. Because honesty is so much easier to keep track of. If you have to, like, that's the worst part about lying. Not the immorality and the backstabbing of others and ultimately losing trust in the social cohesion.
Of course.
No, it's that you have to then keep track of reality and this false reality that you have created. And possibly multiple false realities with everyone you meet. That sounds like a mental headache. Don't do that. Just tell the truth.
It's so much easier.
It's so much easier. Way less mental headache.
You need to write a book on lazy man's ethics.
Lazy man's ethics. I like that. Why tell the truth? It's so much harder to lie.
What if there was an ethical way that you could prove moral foundation based on it's Occam's razoring ethics? It's easier to be a good man.
Thing is, with the tools of rhetoric, I bet it can be done. You can make almost anything. You can make almost any saying sound good as long as you have some rhyme to it. It's
a rhyme?
Not the rhyme. I'm trying to figure out the
phrase
actual,
it a certain way.
It's the literary phrase of using the term twice.
Anger begets anger. Like that?
No, it's doing the whole reversal of lying is not the way to the heart, but a heart is how you lead to lying. Like, you know, like that's that whole thing of like, that's nonsense. That's garbage out of my mouth of, you know, learning is how you consume books, but books is how you lead to learning. It's that stupid rhetoric phrase that everyone finds inspiring that you'll find on dumb posters everywhere of just that. Someone in the comments, please, down below, what that is, a rhetoric phrase. It's a tool that I don't know the name of. I know it has a name. Please comment down below because I forget it. But I now can't unsee it when it happens. Of like, it's a trick.
I'm trying to find it real quick.
It is a trick.
It's a literary tool.
It's a literary trick.
Yeah.
I see it and I don't. Yeah, I like it, I guess. Like, it sounds cool, but like, it's a trick.
I see what you mean, because you make it sound fancier if you just use the same words in a different context. It's somewhat inspirational because you look at the first part of the sentence and go, oh, you have to read the second part of the sentence to recontextualize the first part of the sentence.
It's the that way. I would imagine it's the same exact like feeling of catharsis of when a song has a chorus. Why is the chorus always the best part of a song? Not necessarily the lyrical lines, but people like knowing what's coming. Like, a callback is always loved.
Right.
When you hear a new song and everyone, like, if a band is playing a brand new song at a concert, and so no one in the audience has ever heard the song before, so they can't sing along with the rest of the song, but the chorus they can sing along with because they've now heard it 2-3 times, and it leads up, and they know what's coming. And they can sing along too, and it feels like, oh, this was meant to be. This is cathartic. And that's why people love the chorus and songs.
So next time anybody complains about our intro, it's not changing. It is the Lord of the Rings. Da, 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 yeah. Da. You can all sing along. It's great.
People like predictability. People like to have like a sense of they know that the puzzle piece is coming in when it fills. Mm. And so with those rhetoric tools of where you use the same word but then work your way backwards, it feels like, oh, we used that word before, but now in different contexts I see where it came from. Anyway, it's a satisfying tool. I don't know where we got off there, but
we were talking about your philosophy of lazy Occam's razoring.
Yeah,
every ethical decision.
I probably could. I bet I could do it.
Why kill somebody? Because then you have to hide the body. And yeah, then you have to, it's so much
murder
work. Why
is very difficult.
Marcus Aurelius, he could have just simply said, don't get angry at people because anger is so much effort. Why would you emotionally drain yourself just to be angry? Stop
Forgiveness
it.
Forgiveness is far less emotionally charged. It's much easier to get along with.
Hey, apologizing is likewise. Hey, my bad. I forgive you. Have a good day. How easy is that?
There's simple. To have bitterness, to always try to boast and be egotistical, yeah, is constantly this energy of like showing up others and taking credit from other people's works to better boost your own image. Doesn't that sound exhausting?
That sounds
Why
like
not
a lot
just
of work.
Give other people credit and have humility in the work that you do? That's a lot easier.
I'm following this ethical system right now. This is great.
Yeah. Whatever takes the least amount of mental energy, which, tying it back to Marcus Aurelius,
yep,
of it is your purpose to follow like your nature. And that is the point of following your nature should be natural to you. It should be easy. That is, life can complicate things in your head of like all these different distractions, but you should focus it down, excise all these distractions around that will distract you from your purpose. Do the natural thing. And it is much easier.
What if you're naturally wicked? But what do you argue? It's not natural?
I think wickedness is pretty natural.
Mm.
It's the human
things are
spirit.
Gonna thing.
Yeah. I would say that is the thing that makes mankind different from beasts, is that we have the ability to resist our base urges in nature. It's the whole difference between personally why I see value in stories of I don't think it is very interesting when a story is just about humans' base desires. I inherently it is interesting of a story to have a human character either resist their base desires and succeed, or resist their base desires and fail. But that is ultimately storytelling. If it is just base desire and it's not about the struggle to resist or fail, that is ultimately, I don't think, not even a story.
Just do what you want, man. Just do what you...
Trying to find Wheel of Time there?
Nope.
Nope.
Nope. Just do...
Oh, yeah.
Hey, it's whatever, man.
Wheel of Time.
No.
Wind the Truth. Yeah.
Don't want to give too much for... It's why we had problems.
Yeah.
Yeah, with that.
Well,
yeah.
That's the thing, is our desires are not particularly interesting. I don't think that makes a story.
Oh, my God. Yes, there is a... there. Oh my! I'm so glad I wrote this one down. Oh no, where'd it go? Okay. There was a.
Uh oh.
Damn it!
Also, my notes went away. Where'd they go?
Damn it!
Oh, I brought it back. We're all okay. Good.
I'm going to go to. I'm going to find this quote because exactly what you just said there. There's a quote he has about anger versus desire. Let me see. Okay, I got here's the phrase, because you're talking about our desires and yes. How. Those aren't necessarily a good thing. And okay, here's this point where Marcus Aurelius says this. In comparing sins, the way people do, Theophrastus says that one committed out of desire are worse than the ones committed out of anger, which is a good philosophy. The angry man seems to turn his back on reason out of a kind of pain and inner convulsion. But the man motivated by desire, who is mastered by pleasure, seems somehow more self-indulgent, less manly in his sins. Theophrastus is right and philosophically sound to say that the sin committed out of pleasure deserves a harsher rebuke than the one committed out of pain. The angry man is more like a victim of wrongdoing. Provoked by pain to anger, the other man rushes into wrongdoing on his own, moved by desire. And so what a lob you just gave me there of just that. It reminded me of that view he has and agrees with from Theophrastus of how desire is almost more twisted than you have this wicked desire rather than if you're angered by something, that means something caused that and you're more of a victim of some kind of wrongdoing most of the mm-hmm. time. At least there's more of a reaction. It seems more more twisted to have a desire with ulterior motives than just an emotional reaction. Even though he would say to that, you shouldn't be angry. He's just describing if you're to rank sins, mm-hmm. that wicked desire is worse than just emotional outrage.
Yeah, because it's a clouding your judgment. Normally, it is, yeah, a desire tends to be a failure. Wickedness done out of desire is a failure to rise above your base animal urges, basically. That you are closer to beast than man.
The desire, or would the anger be that? Would do you see anger as more animalistic, or the wicked, or the desire? Is
both are leaning into the like,
animalistic, or
you're giving into your base desires?
Okay,
the virtues are the human virtues are rising above your primal urges. That's what makes it a virtue and not a vice or a sin. But if you were to compare them, anger is temporary, fleeting, a great emotional reaction. A desire tends to be longer term.
Is it lust? Is it greed?
It's not shock. Where anger tends to be very combative to the idea of reason versus desire has time to settle, where reason does have the ability to overcome it, and if it still doesn't, then you have given in, rather than a momentary lapse of weakness.
That's why we judge premeditated murder versus crimes of passion.
Yeah.
In different regards, because one takes a more level of wickedness, where even if it was, this is still not right, but a crime of passion or something in the moment is more emotionally comprehensible than this way more wicked, you had time and chances to not do this. You've mm-hmm. thought this through, makes it worse, which is why you see it referring all the way back to Columbine shooting and the mother of the kid, just why situations like that are like even tenfold across people also dying, children dying, and already being a travesty. Then you get into the mental space of it's even worse when it's premeditated, thought through actions, and it feels as if you had more time humanly to contemplate your actions before making that ethical decision or unethical decision. So yeah, it feels worse and worse and worse. You ever snap at your friend or have some moment to dumb it down, not from like awful things, but you ever snap at your friend and that's way more forgivable to go like, hey man, it's okay. It was a rough night. Something happened, whatever. It's fine. But then if your friend's going behind your back and working on something they're doing something to actually harm you over time, or this jealousy builds or some type of greed builds. Like you look at your friend that's wealthier. You look at your friend that has a nice studio. I can't even say that, but you know why it's so nice is because you've chucked money that you don't have.
Yeah.
This is, if you want to see Rich's house, it's all right here, folks. This is the house.
This is where all the money went.
It's gorgeous.
I spent a lot of time and money on this. The chairs. It is the nicest room in my apartment.
By far, yeah.
By a country mile.
I'm not jealous at all, though. But that seems way worse. So,
well, it's a reason why I personally, I don't know about others, but I dislike passive aggressive behavior far more than actual aggressive behavior. To me, it is a far more negative trait in a colleague, friend, partner in any case, mainly because of the premeditation, the long simmering, the building up of the emotion of like you have with passive aggressive behavior, you have time to actually think about your decisions and you make an active choice over and over and over to continue being wicked toward people that you should care about. That's why it's a reason why it ticks me off greatly. I would much prefer direct anger, aggressive behavior, something to confront then and there. It's understandable. Mm-hmm. And then move on from it.
Yep. Address.
Mm-hmm.
Live in the present, as Marcus Aurelius would say. What can you do right now about the situation? Whereas, yeah, that passive aggressiveness can feel as if they're trying to cause more mental turmoil in you, or the silent treatment, or whatever it might be that is you're trying to psychologically.
There's something cowardly,
yeah,
about passive aggressive behavior that I find disgusting.
Mm.
I mean, everyone's a part of it. We are all hypocrites in this ally thing, but it is something I find disgusting in myself, and I try to correct when I find myself doing it.
Oh yeah, anything that we say on here that we don't like, we're not just victims of perpetrators.
Yeah.
Oh, I've never been passive aggressive.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Ever. Yeah,
but it's definitely a disgusting behavior that at least bothers me greatly.
I see. You shouldn't let it bother you though.
I know. I should.
You shouldn't let the actions of others and passive aggressiveness and these emotions go within your mind, Richard. What would Aurelius say to that? Actually, he would say,
ultimately, don't. But the thing is, it is a treat others as they deserve, as he put it. When I find someone who is being passive aggressive to me, should I anguish on it? Should I take in great emotional pain and disgust from it, or should I just treat them as they deserve and separate myself from their association? That. Or confront them about it. Like that's the thing. It's either, hey, this is behavior that I do not wish to be associated with and tolerate. I will either confront you or I will disassociate. That is it. So, I mean, that's the Marcus Aurelius.
Aurelius just says, take it like a man.
Just take it like a man.
Take the torture. It's not their fault.
That's the thing, is you could twist his words and say, like, hey, don't even try to change others. Like, you should accept when people abuse you, you should just, like, you know, want more of it. Just take it and then, like, accept more of it. No, you have discretion. You can separate yourself from people or confront them or, you know, use your own force to stop them. That is all within the realm of, but again, all of those options are, what can you do about it? Separate, confront, forcibly change them. Change the behavior in some form or fashion. But the focus on, oh, why are they doing this to me? Oh, what do they think? Like, just constantly thinking about them and their actions is not very productive.
I get you. And a lot of that too, are you think that a realist also thinks that too? Are you extrapolating to how you view things? How much of that is a realist versus you?
I think part of that is a realist of like, the point is, what can you do about it? It's useless to think about other people's actions and moralizing it. And ultimately it's not relevant. You can't control their decisions. You can either confront, like, you can't in your own head make them change.
The existence of evil does not harm the world, and an individual act of evil does not harm the victim. Only one person is harmed by it, and he can stop being harmed as soon as he decides to.
Yeah.
Just stop.
That was probably the most extreme aspect that I think most people would disagree with Stoicism on, of just kind of finding it ridiculous of, you know, take someone who's quite literally like being tortured, and it's like, yeah, that person is not a victim as long as in their own head they say they're not. It's like, kind of are. They kind of can be. It's an extreme that it's an extreme to make a point. It's maybe not a realistic, it's not a realistic philosophy, but the principle behind it is sound. And to try and lead yourself in the direction of that extreme is probably a good thing.
I get you. If you're to look at goalposts of like complain about everything or complain about nothing, it's probably toward the nothing. Because he talks about complaining and just what's the point of that as well. And I guess, I don't know if we said this quote, but choose not to be harmed and you won't feel harmed. Don't feel harmed and you haven't been. That's quoted very, very often in meditations to what he's trying to get at when it comes to this.
The most part, generally is true. I think it is more true than it is not.
Gotcha.
At least because I think almost everyone can think of examples in their life of times that they have been wronged, harmed, and all these different aspects. But generally, if enough time has passed, you can kind of like look at it like, all right, I don't care. I think I've told the story about before of like, one of the funniest moments I had in high school of like, maybe this is a Stoicism thing, or it's me just being an idiot, of we were in this friend group, sub theater group activity, and having this whole mushy gush session at the end of senior year.
I remember this.
Yeah. Some guy basically apologized to me. It was like, hey, Rich, I've been treating you really poorly, and I feel really bad about it, and like all these things, and it's like my passive aggressive behavior, and it was unfair to treat you that way. And I was like, thanks, man. I'll be honest, I didn't notice you being like uniquely mean to me. I kind of just thought you were a dick in general. I didn't take it personally. And so I wasn't offended by him. I didn't care what I didn't care about him. I didn't care about his actions. I never once considered myself harmed by him. I was like, that guy's generally a dick. And then I moved on with my life. Like, I'm not harmed by this guy who's like just dickish in general. I thought he's that way to everyone. So I never
you,
felt
you didn't
harmed.
Feel you were getting personalized dick.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you were like,
I
oh,
was
wait.
Getting generalized dick.
Oh, come on. I thought I was just getting like dick, not dick, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
What? Come on, man. I get you, because...
But I never felt harmed
by
his actions that he thinks that he caused me. But then again, that's the point of, I didn't feel I was a victim, and therefore, I wasn't. And that's a small potatoes aspect.
Now, if he knew he was being mean to just you and so kind to everybody else, mm-hmm. little different story of, would you feel... Did you care enough about how he felt about you to perceive this way? Which you don't use social media, but a lot of what social media is today for people is you care so much about, if somebody likes what you're doing, or if somebody is mean to you online, cyberbullying, or just like says something to you, how much should you take that, or take a comment from this video or a comment from anywhere? How much should you personalize that and then take seriously that? I don't want to say criticism, because criticism is good, but honest criticism, feedback, but just meanness and rudeness, or somebody that is just out to get you, whatever it might be. How much did you actually personalize that? And I think Aurelius would say, more so you, I don't know how much Aurelius would say this, but is how closer they are to you. And I would say this too. If they're your family, your friends, care more about what they say. Yes. And then the further you get, the stranger, care less. Far, 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 far less.
Yeah. I mean, it's mainly care about the community that cares about you. Again, I use that. Damn it. That's the rhetoric trick I talked about. That sounds a lot better than it actually is. That sounds deeper than it really is. And I used it unintentionally.
Talking about callbacks.
God damn it.
People love a chorus.
What is that? What is that term? What is that tool? I don't know what it
is. Care about a community that cares about you.
Fuck.
You are so lame.
I'm such a hack.
You are lame. I see why that guy hated you in high school.
Do you get what I mean? But you get what I mean? That sounds like, oh, that sounds like wisdom. And it's like, that's fucking duh bullshit. Yeah.
Well,
put that on a fucking poster.
Don't do what we did and get too emotional about things. If you want to take any stoic lesson from this, what did you learn from meditations? What would you take away from this? And I think, Richard, did you want to end with any big takeaways or messages to leave us with?
If you want an actual breakdown of the four lessons I took from it, go ahead, watch our old video about
the 8-minute one.
Yeah, that's actually directly, hey, here's what Marcus Aurelius says, and there we go. This was our musings and our discussion about the book and our thoughts mainly.
If you can't tell, we like philosophy books a little bit.
A philosophy book? Is this a man's own self-help book to himself? Generally that.
You decide. Let us know what you think down below. We had a good time. All right. Yeah. We'll see y'all later.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.